listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times, in for Lizzie O'Leary. Lizzie's just back from a reporting trip. Later on in the hour, we'll check in with her and see what she's been up to. Also this week, we asked for your stories on how you're spending money on education. We'll hear what you had to say. Coming up, is ride-sharing, you know, Uber, Lyft, is it headed to a mass transit system near you? Also, we'll meet an entrepreneur who's launched a stock market for high-end sneakers. Yes, it's real. Topping it all off, comedian Eric Andre takes the Marketplace quiz. As always, if you have thoughts for us, come and share them on marketplace.org or on our Facebook page or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. Thanks for spending your Labor Day weekend with us. Let's get to work. Let's start off with our segment, Long and Short. That's where we take a position on current events, but in the language of finance, things we like, that's a long position. Things we're not so hot on, that's a short position. You know how it works. This week, we've got Marketplace's Kimberly Adams and Danielle Belton, managing editor of The Root. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
All right, let's start with you, Kimberly. What are you long on?
I am going to go long on Cuban tourism, specifically Americans going to Cuba for vacations. And watch out, Mexico, because Cuba wants your tourists. The first scheduled commercial passenger flight from the U.S. to Cuba in half a century happened this week, and it's opening the door to many, many more to come. The same day that a JetBlue flight went to Cuba, the Department of Transportation announced who was going to get the very lucrative contracts to fly to Havana, and that's going to be American Airlines. And I think that because there's been so much attention and the airlines were literally fighting each other trying to get these contracts, it's showing that lots and lots of people are interested to go to Cuba. The cruise lines are already heading there, and so I think Cuba's about to see a lot more of our smiling American faces.
And for everyone playing along at home, this is like the first time in 50 years we saw a commercial flight landing there.
Right, right. Incredible. And
yeah, that's a very big deal. But I mean, tell me, Kimberly, can Cuba handle this? I read that they had relatively few hotel rooms. Where's everyone going to stay?
I guess at people's houses. I mean, can Cuba handle it? I think that there's definitely a lot of people in Cuba who are looking forward to the opportunity to host tourists. And definitely there's a lot of hotel chains, specifically American hotel chains, that are getting ready to set up shop there. So I imagine the infrastructure is going to scale up pretty quickly, as it does in many countries where there's a sudden burst of tourism.
I was going to ask if they have Airbnb in Cuba.
Well, whatever they call it, maybe they got something like that. So, Kimberly, what are you short on?
So for short, I am going to go EU and U.S. economic relations, because right now the United States Department of Treasury is really, really upset at the European Union and their commission because of this massive $14.5 billion penalty that the EU says Apple needs to pay in back taxes to Ireland. There's so much going on here in terms of this special deal that Apple had worked out with Ireland to pay effectively no taxes many years. But Apple's like, it was a deal we worked out with the country, so it's fine, and Ireland's okay, and we're okay, so why are you bothering us? But the EU says it's not fair and that it represented state aid. The Department of Treasury doesn't like this because it could mean that the Treasury Department might end up having to, in a weird way of complicated accounting, have to foot the bill and lose revenue as a result of Apple paying these taxes if it has to. Ireland doesn't like this deal because they're worried about losing these jobs. Apple doesn't like this deal because it thinks it means that if they strike a deal with one country, it's going to fall apart elsewhere. And so things are a little bit tense.
Well, wait, roll that back. How would the Treasury have to foot the bill?
Right. So it's a weird thing. I was speaking to some economists and they said if Apple ends up having to pay this $14.5 billion in taxes, it may be that they can then write it off as a credit on their U.S. corporate taxes. And if that's the case, then that's basically a $14.5 billion deduction in terms of the amount of revenue that the U.S. Department of Treasury can bring in. So Apple may not even care if they have to buy it, because either way, they'll probably come out on top. At least according to several of the economists that explained this to me. I am not an accountant or a corporate tax lawyer. That's what they tell me.
Yeah, well, worth pointing out as well that Apple managed to get its effective corporate tax rate in Ireland down to 0.0005%. That's a low tax rate.
Yeah, so they'll probably work something out if they have to pay it.
Yeah, I want that tax rate too. So Danielle, what are you long on?
You know, I am long on athletes protesting. you know, there's been a lot of talk about Colin Kaepernick. He was sitting down during a 49ers preseason game.
Sitting down during the national anthem.
Yes, sitting down during the national anthem. And a reporter asked him essentially, you know, why he did that. And he explained, he said, I am not going to stand up and show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color. To me, this is bigger than football. And it would be selfish on my part to look the other way. There are bodies in the street and people are getting paid leave and getting away with murder. So essentially, he's talking about the crisis that's going on between police and the African-American community right now, where you've had cases like Philando Castile, Alton Sterling, you know, men who were shot by police officers under suspicious circumstances, essentially. And so Kaepernick is just doing what, you know, LeBron James has done this summer, over the year, what you've had WNBA players have come out talking about these issues around police brutality and the African-American community. And I feel like you're just going to see more and more of it, despite the fact that he's gotten a lot of criticism from some athletes, especially retired athletes. In particular, Jerry Rice and Tiki Barber both came out kind of, you know, with the All Lives Matter, can't we all just get along talk? But the reality is, this is a serious issue going on right now in the African-American community around police violence. And the fact that he wanted to speak up, especially when he's not necessarily in the same position as a LeBron is when LeBron speaks up. I mean, LeBron has an NBA championship under his belt. So, you know, he's speaking out from a much more comfortable position. Kaepernick is essentially a backup quarterback right now.
I'm not challenging the validity of what Kaepernick is saying, but I know a lot of sports fans are thinking, yeah, but not during the national anthem.
So, I mean, it's funny when people say that, you know, you shouldn't be bringing political statements into sports arenas and you need to keep the politics outside of it. But one of my friends said on Twitter, standing up and saluting a flag and doing the national anthem in a sports game is bringing politics into sports. And what interests me about this is sort of what Danielle was mentioning, what kind of leverage you have to do these kinds of acts. Because if you're a LeBron and you have millions and millions of dollars and you're such a celebrity, you can get away with it. But I mean, are there going to be fines for athletes who do these kinds of political statements? Do they risk losing their job or getting banned from a certain number of games? What is the risk to them for this, and who's going to be willing to take it?
Kaepernick's a young guy, and there's already insider reports that he could be facing a potential cut from the team, which people are saying is really suspicious in the timing.
So what are you short on, Danielle?
I am short on Donald Trump in Mexico.
No.
Yeah, just a little short on that. You know, Donald Trump went to Mexico this week to meet with President Enrique Peña Nieto. He met with him on Wednesday, essentially to talk about Mexican-U.S. relations.
I was watching the speech and the reporters were literally like jumping out of their seats, like, what about the wall? And he said, you know, we discussed the wall. We didn't discuss who will pay for the wall. Really?
Yeah, really? That's what I thought, too. I mean, of all the things you're not going to bring up, that's the one?
Well, this is why I'm short on Trump in Mexico, because I feel like Trump literally will tailor whatever message depending on the audience. So if he's talking to the president of Mexico, suddenly, you know, who's going to pay for the wall is not a big deal. There's no need to really bring it up. We're best buddies now.
And it also gave Trump a chance to do something that he said he would do, which is show himself to be diplomatic. And so to go to a foreign country and step away from some of the rhetoric that he's had on the campaign trail and say, look, I can play nicely when I travel. And even though some of the statements he made were a little bit tone deaf, he did, you know, go on for quite a while about how Mexican Americans are really, really good workers, which probably offended some. But at the same time, he did really, really tone down some of the things that he was saying. And I think that he's going to use this to try and demonstrate that he can be diplomatic and he can speak calmly about important international issues, which has been a big criticism that he's faced.
Long and short. And that's another week of it. Kimberly Adams, Daniel Belton, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Nice to talk to you.
When we try to understand the economy, we look to economic indicators, GDP, unemployment, consumer spending. But here's the thing. The economy is relative. It's personal. That's why we and some of the other marketplace programs have been collecting stories from people all over the country about what the economy feels like to them. We call it My Economy. Today we hear from a woman who has to juggle multiple jobs to make ends meet.
My name is Rolanda Brown, and my age is 42, and I live in St. Louis, Missouri. I am a NA, which is a nurse assistant. It's home health care, and I take care of elders. I cook, clean, bathe, change, make sure they take their meds, do a little grocery shopping, things like that. My second job, I'm a lab technician, and I draw blood, I run tests. My third job is a sitter, and I watch patients to make sure they're not trying to harm themselves or no one else. The most I ever brought home from working all three of my jobs was probably $1,700, $1,800 a month. $1,700 is not enough for me to live. I almost lost my home. We lost our cars, so we don't have a car. My utilities had got cut off, but I got assistance through different agencies. I go to food pantries to get food. I used my 401k savings to bury my dad 2 years ago. And then a year later, my daughter gets diagnosed with cancer. I worry so much and I be stressed so much. My health got bad and I was diagnosed with anxiety and panic attacks. My levels of stress is so high that I could have a stroke or heart attack any day, any day. I pray every day. I have so many Bibles upstairs. I try to just stay positive, and I just believe that it's going to get better. My life will be better.
If you want to hear more stories from our My Economy series or share your own story, visit marketplace.org and search for My Economy. This week, ITT Technical Institute, that's a chain of for-profit colleges, announced that it will no longer be enrolling new students. The news came after the federal government stopped the college's parent company from enrolling new students who use federal financial aid. Now, that's an interesting time for education in the United States. Schools are getting ever more competitive and ever more expensive. And this week, we ask you to tell us your stories about money and education. Let's start with Fiona Pomsiddiqui. She's 45 and lives in Miami. She recently placed her kids in public school after originally having them in a private preschool. Right off the bat, she was surprised that parents were expected to stock their children's classrooms.
You know, we want to give the kids and the teachers their best foot forward, so happy to supply them, but I do feel it is like a double dipping thing in terms of already being assessed for taxes, and then we have to buy all these supplies. I'm not clear on the intricacies of the public school system and why there isn't funding for basic supplies like paper towels and things like that. I find that a little odd, but I think it is kind of probably a burden on your average person who's maybe making like $50,000 or $60,000 a year to spend $100 here and there constantly for supplies and uniforms is probably, you know, difficult.
What will the public school system have to do to keep you in the system, not just through elementary, but also middle school and high school?
Just have a good academic environment and hopefully something in the arts if the kids are interested in, or at least like a survey program, which I think is good for all kids. Participation in sports, whether they, you know, would like it or not, because I think, you know, it's something that kids should be exposed to, even if they're not going anywhere with it or it's not their favorite thing. Basically, you know, a strong academic environment and a fairly pleasant school where there don't seem to be a lot of problems with the student body.
Fiona Pomsiddiqui in Miami, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Then there are families that have taken an alternative route. Kristen Wakeham is 43. She lives in Atlantic Mine, Michigan, and is homeschooling her two kids.
For my two children for this year, I spent roughly $600, but that includes supplies, paper, paints, and clays for my preschool and whatnot. But I would say roughly $300 was what I looked at for just general standard basic curriculum.
And you're now a teacher. Who compensates you for your time?
Well, I do work outside the home one day a week, but as far as my time for educating the child, I guess the payment is the reward of knowing that we're giving our children the best of ourselves. And so so far, I feel like they're getting an excellent education. There's a ways to go yet. So there's a lot of intangible payment, but there's definitely, you know, opportunity costs that we didn't talk about, you know, instead of I opted to quit my job to do this at home. So there are costs, but the rewards, I mean, you can't really put a price tag on that.
You quit your job to do this. What were you doing?
I was a grant writer and grant administrator for a public institution.
What is the loss of income meant for your family?
Well, we budget very closely. We haven't really changed too much with our lifestyle just because we were in preparation for what we knew for a while that this was coming. So we kind of used the extra income for a while to pay down our debts so that we have very little debt at this time, so that actually the lifestyle change isn't too great other than that we really do watch it more.
And at the back end, when you finally launch your kids off into a college career, are you going to dive back into the work pool?
That's the plan.
All right, Kristen Wakeham, thank you very much for joining us.
You're most welcome. Thanks for having me.
Lastly, the challenge of taking on student debt. Ryan Roth is 34. He lives in Madison, Wisconsin, and is a third-year internal medicine resident. Ryan went to business school before moving on to med school, and he says the cost of tuition, well, it's a handful.
You know, it varies from school to school, but I think in general it's safe to say at least $150,000. And I would say more commonly I hear numbers around $200,000 or more, depending on how you live while you're in medical school.
Well, that's a big chunk of change. How do most people deal with it?
Anecdotally, when I talk to some of my colleagues and certainly some of my friends when I was in medical school, a lot of people put it on the back burner and don't think about it, anticipating that they're going to be able to pay it off somehow in the future.
In other words, after they become a thoracic surgeon, they'll have oodles of bucks and then they can pay it down.
Exactly right. You know, and then there's some programs out in the country that, you know, if you work in an underserved area, hopefully the government will pay off your debt. I think some of those programs are in flux with our current political environment. But yeah, most people I talk to don't think about their debt. And if I press them a little bit just to see how they're dealing with it, a lot of the people are just paying the minimum amount that's due every month.
So not just for doctors, but for anybody carrying some student debt right now, what's your advice?
My advice would be to find a compound interest calculator on the internet, plug in how much debt you have, and look at how that grows over the lifetime that you plan to pay it off.
And compound interest, for everyone playing along at home, is when you earn interest on an account, the interest gets folded back into that account, and thus it just keeps growing exponentially.
That's right. And then a lot of these calculators actually show that if you pay a little bit more than the minimum every month, how you'd end up paying way less interest in the long run.
So it sounds like the smart play here is you sit down with some financial advisor, explain your long-term horizons, explain your desire to get out of debt at a certain date, and work out a game plan.
I think so. I think you probably also have to be careful with your who you choose as a financial advisor. Here in residency, I get people soliciting me all the time from financial advisor firms. And I've seen some lectures in front of all my residents where, quite frankly, bad advice is given. And so ultimately, I would try to get a recommendation from a friend so it's somebody that you can trust.
Ryan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, David.
Next week, we're keeping the conversation going. We want to hear your stories about money and education. Are you spending on yourself, on your kids? What have you learned? What have you figured out? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, or you can chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page. Just do a search for Marketplace Business News, or call 1-800-648-5114. We've been talking about how you pay for education, and the biggest education cost, well, it's almost always college. That's what Lizzie O'Leary's been reporting on with our partners at the PBS NewsHour and Frontline. And she's here to give us a preview. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, David.
So you've been off on assignment. Tell us what you've been working on.
What we are looking at here is some multi-part question within a big question, which is, Why is there so much student debt? We're talking about $1.3 trillion. About 42 million people have student debt. And that's kind of nested inside this question of why college is so expensive. And so we're looking at that and kind of trying to unpack it a little bit, figure out what that means for borrowers, what that means for the political system. Obviously, this comes up on the campaign trail, and whether there are changes in store.
How did we get here? I mean, how did it ever get so big?
On the one hand, and this is very important, the cost of college, and I'm using college to encompass four-year public universities, private universities, community colleges, and for-profits, has gone up. If you look at, for example, what states are spending, that's gone down because obviously we had a recession. We've had a lot of budget crunches. So the share of money that states spend on colleges right now is roughly the same as it was in 1966. So that's kind of mind-blowing. Also, more people are going to college. You know, it's less elitist than it used to be. So in that respect, more debt is maybe a good thing. More borrowers is a good thing because more people are going to college. Another key part of this is that middle-class incomes have remained stagnant. As we know, we've talked about that a lot, which means that the share that families pay of their income for college has also gone way up. So if you're a low-income family, for example, you're spending about 40% of your income on college costs, and that's up from 29% in 2007. We spoke to this professor, Sarah Goldrick-Robb, who teaches at Temple. She wrote a book called Paying the Price about this. She's been researching it. And one of the things that's going on here is sort of we give this message to people saying college will help you get in the middle class, but they're also being saddled with debt since these other amounts of money have gone down. Borrowers are taking out more and more. Students are shouldering that cost. And so there's sort of a wealth transfer and maybe questions about whether that cost helps you actually stay in the middle class or could hurt you. Here's Sarah Goldrick-Robb.
Your ability to get into the middle class hinges on you being able to pay enough money to be in college to the point that you get a degree. And so many students are paying a price that's so untenable to them that they can't complete the degree. Without that degree, these days, people have debt to pay off and no higher credential to help them in the labor market. That's a big change from the past.
So the average borrower has somewhere in the neighborhood of $30,000 in debt. And for a lot of people, that's okay because their earnings go up. They'll be able to pay that off throughout their life. But for people who did not finish or maybe went to a for-profit school where the credential is not what they thought it would be, that $30,000 in debt or even $10,000 in debt, you know, it becomes this anchor that is weighing on their life, and it is incredibly hard to pay it off.
A lot of moving parts in there. How does all this play out with borrowers?
You know, I think it sort of depends on the borrower, and it sort of depends on the degree. We met a couple of borrowers who went to for-profit schools and didn't finish, one of whom, you know, did 3 years, had about $30,000 in debt, and he feels like it was a terrible decision. He's okay now, sort of, in terms of his debt. He's paid it down to about $17,000, but it is getting in the way of the ability to do anything else. His credit is destroyed. He can't take out a mortgage. We met other people who have gone back to living with their parents who are not pursuing the kind of jobs that they thought they would be. You know, one of them said, I'm going to be paying this off until I die. I might even have debt forever, you know, even after she's gone.
With a problem this complicated, obviously there's no one size fits all, but are there any solutions out there?
Obviously, this has come up a lot on the campaign trail. You know, Bernie Sanders had this free college idea. When you talk to some of the academics who study this, some of them come down on free college as a broad policy thing and say, that's not so great because it doesn't differentiate between income brackets, right? Why would you give free college to everybody if someone's family could afford to send them to college? Maybe free tuition at community colleges. Or one thing that Hillary Clinton has talked about, you know, one of her policies would be some free schools indexed to income. You know, if you're talking about four-year colleges, Donald Trump has looked at maybe, you know, doing this by major, whether you have a major that might be more beneficial in the job market. It is a very big issue. We've also looked at the servicers. So that's, you know, maybe you borrowed from the federal government, but now it's Navient or another company that calls you, sends you mail, et cetera. I think that's an area that is ripe for reform. There are very few guidelines in terms of how servicers need to act. And I think that's an area where we could see some real changes in terms of how these companies go about servicing loans that after all, the federal government is eventually providing.
We'll be hearing more from Lizzie O'Leary on this story in coming weeks. And of course, Lizzie back in the big seat here at the show next week. Lizzie, thanks so much.
Thank you. And thanks for watching The Store, David.
Has come a long way in 7 years. It's pushed beyond its ride-sharing base to explore self-driving cars, food deliveries, and now it's looking to break into an even more unexpected area, public transit. Joshua Brustein is a reporter at Bloomberg who wrote about the company's foray into this new frontier. Joshua, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So this is a really unexpected move on these companies' parts, the idea that they would get in on a municipal transit service. Where is this happening?
There have been a couple of smaller cities around the U.S. where they've started some experiments. Uber and Lyft got their start in places like San Francisco and New York, big, dense cities. For the bus systems, it's more like places like Pinellas Park, Florida, which is a suburb of Tampa. There's also an experiment going on in Centennial, Colorado, and the outskirts of Denver. So these are places which have bus systems, but a lot of times there are lines that are really serving very few customers, are really expensive to run, and they're kind of hungry for alternatives.
How does it work? Are Uber and Lyft drivers just making regular routes around the city?
There are a number of different models being experimented with, but mostly what we're seeing is in places that are poorly served by bus routes, local governments are subsidizing Uber or Lyft rides so long as you take them to another form of public transportation. If you're in an area that doesn't connect to the commuter rail, you might get a subsidized ride-sharing ride to that rail so that the city doesn't have to run a bus or figure out some way to get you there.
Does this mean a cutback in public transit service?
So in some places, it's been a response to cutbacks that were going to happen anyway. These lines were losing a lot of money, and they said, we're going to have to cut these lines, but we can dedicate some resources to running this ride-sharing program instead. There's been some grant money available for them, so they've been able to tap into that.
What have communities said about this? Are they embracing it, or is there any concern about safety, for example, or timeliness?
So far, the response seems to be pretty positive. I think that one of the reasons that Uber and Lyft like this idea is that it allows them to seem like they are playing nice with local governments. In other areas, obviously, they do not have that reputation. In fact, in some places, they seem to be providing these transportation alternative services in the same places where they've been fighting it out over taxi regulations.
What I find sort of troubling about this is the idea that a public utility, public transportation in this case, is effectively being outsourced to the private sector. But not just that, it's being outsourced to amateurs.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that if this begins to reach a larger scale, I think that's going to be one of the dynamics that they're going to have to struggle with, both the policymakers in justifying doing this. And I think that the attention for the ride-sharing companies won't be unanimously positive going forward. I think right now what they've been able to do is say, like, these are small-scale experiments. Let's see what happens. The other potentially concerning thing is if you start replacing union bus drivers with ride-sharing drivers, obviously those are two very different kinds of jobs.
With very different kinds of benefits, as in one of them has them and one of them doesn't.
Exactly.
Do you envision a lot of regulatory scrutiny as to the changes? I would imagine there are many municipalities that would welcome a change like this because public transportation is not a moneymaker.
There's essentially nowhere a public transportation agency pays for its costs with just the fares that it collects. So I do think that this will be tempting, especially for the types of routes that are the hardest to run. It will be interesting. The public officials who I talked to were surprisingly sanguine about any sort of regulatory questions. They didn't seem to have a lot of the hang-ups that other local officials have had about ride-sharing in other contexts.
In your case, would you prefer to take Uber or take the subway?
Well, in New York City, the fastest way to get anywhere is the subway, so I think that's what I'm going to stick for in getting to work.
Joshua Brustein is a reporter at Bloomberg. Joshua, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We love our numbers here at Marketplace. You know we do. And every day we collect some of our favorites on our By the Numbers blog. Here's Marketplace's Eliza Mills and Tony Wagner with some of this week's news by the numbers. Eliza?
Thanks, David. Our first number is
2,100.
That's how many properties across the country have flooded more than 10 times.
It's a tiny portion of flood insurance policies, but frequently flooded homes account for 10% of money paid out.
That's a big drain on the National Flood Insurance Program, which is more than $20 billion in debt.
26%.
That's the portion of Japan's population that's over 65, making it one of the oldest countries in the world.
Japanese seniors have billions and billions in buying power, so that means businesses are adapting in ways big and small.
Vacuums are getting lighter, escalators are getting slower, and adult diapers outsell baby diapers.
$20,000.
That's how much a life-size nude statue of Donald Trump could fetch at auction next month.
The statues of the GOP presidential nominee popped up in several cities in August. All of them were confiscated or destroyed but one.
Another piece depicting a clothed Hillary Clinton is only expected to bring in $15,000.
Sad.
Sad.
Time for the Marketplace Quiz. That's when we bring in musicians, writers, other well-known people, and we ask them questions about work and money, how it's shaped their lives or taught them important lessons. Here's Marketplace producer Haley Hirschman with this week's guest, whose show you may have seen on Adult Swim.
Hey, I'm Eric Andre, and you can't spell American Dream without Eric Andre.
All right, first question.
Yes.
Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you...
Pizza.
Next question. What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
I'll tell you, I bought a house a year and a half ago. And right after I bought it, like a few months went by, and I was like, I want to move back to New York City. Why did I buy an L.A. house? And it was a lot of money, and I was like, I don't want to live here anymore. You know, it's funny. Almost every comedian I started out with moved to L.A., except for my two friends, Hannibal Buress and Amy Schumer. And my two friends that are doing the best in comedy, the most successful friends I have, are Hannibal Buress and Amy Schumer. And they were just both like, no, I'm not going to move to L.A. I love New York. I'm staying in New York. And I was like, nah, you got this years ago. I'm like, you got to, man. You ain't going to make it out in New York. You got to move to L.A. And they were both like, nah, I think I'm fine. I think I'm going to do fine sticking it out in New York. And I was like, man, you two don't know what you're talking about. And now they are millionaires. So I was like, maybe they're on to something. And I think New York as a comedian is just healthier for you. Keeps your edge. I was planning to move back to New York. That was my plan. And then I just got stuck here.
When did you realize comedy could be a career?
I think a few weeks ago. I'm always afraid that it's going to end or I'm going to mess something up or fail and it doesn't feel like secure. This is the most job security I've felt since I started. And I still feel like I got to continue pounding the pavement or it's just going to vanish and dry up. So,
do you remember your first paying gig?
First paying gig, I got $20. I played at some really weird venue. I don't even remember the venue. I just remember it was the last stop on the A train. It was like the Far Rockaways, Queens. And there was like an audience of like three people. And I think they gave me a check. And I thought about framing the check, and I never did because I needed 20 bucks. So I was like, this is like three meals right here.
What is something everyone should own no matter the cost?
I bought this book called Healing Back Pain. That kind of saved my life, by Dr. John Sarno. Basically, you have all these physical ailments, back pain, colitis, ulcers. Your body manifests all these physical symptoms because it's trying to create distractions from unwanted repressed emotions in your subconscious mind. It's like a defense mechanism. So through therapy and journaling, basically taking all the repressed anger and rage and upsetting emotions that you kind of are always playing on a loop in the background in your unconscious mind, voluntarily bringing those to your conscious mind through therapy and through journaling, your body no longer needs to create defense mechanisms because you're coping. Changed my life. I had like horrible back pain from when I was like 18 to like a year ago. It also made it help with my work. I think journaling is actually like a key to success. You can have set clear goals for yourself. You can start noticing repetitive behavior patterns and see like the type of things that are springing up that keep bothering you and keep bothering you. And then you can have a bird's eye view of it. And it's just totally in all aspects of my life has bettered my life.
What advice do you wish someone had given you before you started comedy?
To not be so hard on myself and embrace the process and realize that it's like a career in comedy is like learning how to swim. You know, when the swim instructor would just throw you in the pool as a little kid and you'd have to like fight for your life to get out of the water and breathe air. That's kind of what comedy is like. And it's a ton of failure and rejection for like the first 10 years. That's what makes you professional. It makes you able to cope with any crappy situation. But I was miserable for the first 10 years doing this. This is really hard. It's really hard. I'm so shocked that I got anywhere because I was so broke and so confused and depressed and anxious.
Well, you made it.
I made it out alive.
Good job.
Hopefully. I think I did.
The fourth season of The Eric Andre Show airs on Fridays at midnight on Adult Swim. Financial markets, stocks, bonds, derivatives, old news, right? Okay, try this one on for size. A stock market for sneakers. Yeah, it's totally real. It's called StockX, and if the company has its way, it'll be a high-tech trading post for more than just Adidas and Nikes. Josh Luber is its CEO. Josh, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you?
So tell me a little bit about StockX. What is it? How does it work?
StockX is an e-commerce marketplace, right? It's not unlike eBay or Amazon in that it's a place where people can buy or sell sneakers, but we connect buyers and sellers the exact same way the stock market connects buyers and sellers, which means that there is a market price and both sides, buyer or seller, can transact immediately across that market price whenever they want. And if you have market pricing, then you have transparency into data. What do things actually sell for? How much are things actually worth? And once you have a lot better data, you can make better buying decisions and better selling decisions.
All right. So to differentiate it from Amazon, it sounds like rather than Amazon posting a single price and then other people stepping up to buy it at that price, you've got people offering to pay a certain amount and others offering to sell at a certain amount, and you're a market maker.
That's exactly what it is, right? People place asks, how much they're willing to sell something for. People place bids, how much they're willing to buy something for. When a bid and ask meet, the transaction happens automatically, just the way it does in the market.
How do I know I'm getting the real deal when I make this transaction?
That is a crucial part to any market, right? That both buyer and seller know with 100% confidence of what they're getting. And there's a huge problem with fake sneakers out in the marketplace. So at StockX, we physically authenticate every pair of sneakers that's sold. Seller ships it to us in our office in Detroit. We authenticate it and we ship it off to the buyer.
How do you do that? How do you authenticate a pair of Air Jordans?
Yeah, so that's not exactly an existing industry yet. So we have been doing everything we can to be able to identify, you know, what are the fakes, what are the real ones. One of the really good examples is Adidas has a sole called the Boost. The Boost is a very soft, squishy sole. Usually on fake shoes where they have a fake Adidas Boost, it's very hard. And you can tell almost immediately by touching it, by squeezing it, if that is not a real shoe. Others, it's as simple as things like a real version uses red stitching and the fake one might have black stitching. And those sort of identifiers, we learn over time and get better at identifying them.
So I receive those pair of Boosts that I've purchased at what I believe to be a fair market price. You were talking about how you guys amass troves of data. Am I now able to track the value of my sneakers on a daily basis?
We have a function called sneaker portfolios where you can track the value of your sneaker collection the exact same way you would a stock portfolio. You can see its value over time, have access to the same analytics that if you went on to your Schwab brokerage account and saw what your portfolio is worth.
And that might strike some people as silly, but there are, in fact, so-called sneakerheads out there to whom this is a very, very important thing.
Not only that, it starts to become more important to the people around them. So we've had insurance companies approach us about having access to that data to write policies for sneakerheads who want to insure their sneakers.
All right. I used to collect comic books as a kid. I imagine that the model you're creating here is applicable to virtually any collectible, whether it's comic books or Beanie Babies or sneakers.
The hypothesis is that anything that's not already a unique one-of-a-kind item, like a work of art or a house, and anything that's not already a purely commoditized product, like, say, plastic water bottles or toilet paper, anything else, and in particular things that have very high resale value and a lot of collectors, you can buy or sell using the stock market concept. And so, you know, it really does work. And it's just a function for us as we move beyond sneakers to figure out exactly how that scales. Because unlike a purely digital product, how you determine a real sneaker is different than how you determine a real baseball card.
So why would I want to use StockX as opposed to putting my Honus Wagner card up on eBay?
If you were to go onto eBay and you were to look for a Honus Wagner card, to look for any sneaker, you will get 10, 50, 100, 1,000 results. If you go to the buy a share of Apple stock from the New York Stock Exchange, there's one ticker symbol for Apple stock, and every bid and every ask is right there. So that transparency of data also leads to just an easier buying and selling experience. No one's ever going to miss your Honus Wagner on StockX if they're coming to look for one. But they could go search for it on eBay, and they could miss that because there's tens, hundreds, thousands of them there.
You're obviously seeing a lot of different shoes going by your desk. What's your very favorite?
Well, there's a difference between the nostalgic favorites and the ones you wear the most today. I still have sneakers from when I was in seventh grade. But today, the shoe that I wear the most is one called the Air Jordan 1 Lance Mountain. And it's got some really cool designs to it and a shoe I can wear every day.
Josh Luber is the CEO of StockX. Thank you so much, Josh.
Thank you.
Many of you are on vacation for Labor Day, and we hope it's going well. But that's gotten us thinking about how tourists outside the U.S. may be taking some time off. One place that's trying to turn itself into a tourist paradise is the Russian port city of Vladivostok. Nestled on the Pacific coast, Vladivostok was once a major military hub. Now it's a gathering place for Chinese tourists. China is the largest, most important, and wealthiest neighbor Russia has in the region. And you don't have to go far in Vladivostok to see Chinese tourists or people doing business. For more, here's the BBC's Marie Keyworth.
My name is Zhang Tongrui. I come from China. I'm 27 years old.
Zhang Tongrui is enjoying a bird's-eye view of Vladivostok. From the Eagle's Nest, a popular tourist spot which gives a stunning vista over the city and the harbour. He's one of a gaggle of Chinese tourists clustering around taking photos and admiring the scenery of their northern neighbour.
I think Russia is a very beautiful country. Not many people. And Russia is so big.
He's not the only one who's fallen for Russia's charms. There's been an explosion in the number of people visiting the Russian Far East from China. In the first 6 months of this year, 100,000 Chinese tourists came to Vladivostok's Primorsky Krai region. That's nearly twice as many as the same time last year. Zhang Tongrui hints at what's behind the sudden enthusiasm.
It's cheap, very cheap.
Since 2014, the value of the ruble has collapsed. In January this year, it hit its lowest level in 13 years, mainly because of the global fall in the price of oil. All this has suddenly made Russia cheap compared to China. Chun Unlin is a tour guide from Zhushanghai, a city close to the Russian border. She's worked as a tour group leader for over 4 years.
Vladivostok is very beautiful and the people are very polite and friendly. Every year, more and more people come. Especially this year, very many are coming because of the price. The trip is very cheap.
50 kilometres away, the gaming machines are whirring at the Tigre de Cristal Casino. This place is a first for Russia. After President Vladimir Putin decided to close all the country's casinos in 2006, 5 gaming zones were created in the Russian Federation. This one, outside Vladivostok in Russia's Far East, is the first to get up and running.
My name is Craig Ballantyne. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for G1 Entertainment, which is Tigre de Cristal, the actual operation itself. Our company is based in Hong Kong. We opened last year, October the 8th. During the winter period, we had approximately 400 to 500 people daily, and now we have over 1,000 daily.
When this area is finished, there'll be 5 casinos, 7 hotels, and facilities for yachting, fishing, hunting, and a golf course. The plan is to draw in the Chinese from over the border, which is only 3 hours away. There are millions of potential customers across Asia who are closer to Vladivostok than to Macau.
Behind those walls is our VIP areas for the Asian players.
Can we go and look at the VIP room? Am I allowed?
We can go and have a quick look because there's no cameras involved. But if there was cameras, you wouldn't be allowed in.
So this is one of 7 private gaming rooms in the casino, and there are about 60 Chinese people crowded around 4 gaming tables here, all of them trying their luck at a bit of baccarat. Some people are standing around, they're smoking, but there is a definite air of intense concentration in here. So we've just been in that VIP room looking at Chinese players crowded around that baccarat table. How much in the future is this casino and this whole integrated area going to rely on those visitors?
Well, of course, this is the whole idea. We're here because of its position to China. In fact, you could say that there are 300 million people within a 2-hour flight time of Vladivostok. So that's our market.
But not everyone can be a winner in the shifting economic game.
Because of the ruble that is down too much, we had no orders for the last 2 years, then lost a lot of money, came back here, and the season worked.
Roman Tubelov is 33 and has spent the last 9 years living in China, working in a trading business. He was taking orders from Chinese factories for things like porcelain tiles, furniture, laminate flooring, and exporting them to Russia. Because of the drop in the ruble, he's been forced to return to his native Vladivostok to be a tour guide for Chinese tourists.
One RMB product became 2 RMB product, but we still buy a lot of things from China, but not that quantity.
But you still lost your job, unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately, I lost my job and find another one.
And that other job is to use his Chinese language skills to show his country off to some happy customers.
I think Russia is a very beautiful country. And China and Russia friendship is very good.
That's Marie Keyworth from our partners at the BBC. And that's our show for this week. Lizzie's back next week as we continue our stories about money and education. Are you spending on yourself? On your kids? What have you learned? What have you figured out? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org or chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page. Just do a search for Marketplace Business News. Or call 1-800-648-5114 and your voice might be featured on the air, so no naughty words, okay? Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman, Cerise Castle, and Eliza Mills. Dan Samatovich is our senior producer. Jake Gorski's our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark's our vice president. I'm David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times, and until next time, I'll see you in the business section. This is APM.